How would he react to our place in his kingdom? How would he react in regards to our own relationship with our family, both Christian and physical bloodline? And how would he react in to our daily interaction with the world? Because you see, it's not just this hour we spend here. It's not just a few moments maybe we spend in prayer or reading his word each day. It's a life pursuit. It's something that we should look at and we should examine each and every day. I guess I should have made this a little bigger. This is a passage from Proverbs. But you know, Jesus himself lived a very radical lifestyle. You know, we know that he came from a very traditional background. He was born and raised a Jew, and he came from a society that was very, very traditional. But we know that he was fully divine, yet he was fully human. You know, one of the things that I get tossing around once in a while, and I just, before I say this, I want you to know that it doesn't really have any big bearing, but it's one of those conundrums, if you want to so to speak, about things. You know, Jesus was divine. He was the Son of God. But the question I have is, can God live a perfect life? Is it any big deal that God would live a perfect life? Is that any big deal?
Yeah.
Why is it a big deal?
Well,
I understand, but we're told that evil cannot even be near God. It can't be near him, because as soon as it comes into his presence, it's destroyed. You know, one of the things about, and I digress momentarily, but if you read Revelation, you know, and the defeat of Satan, you know, it builds up, several chapters, it builds up to where this great conflict comes in. And then the Lamb rides in on the great white horse, and what happens to evil? We don't have six chapters of this big battle, do we? It's over. It's over in a minute. So I get back to the point is, if God can live a perfect life, he has to, I mean, there's no choice. So what's the big deal that Jesus lived a perfect life if he was God? Now, if he lived it as a human, that's a big deal, isn't it? How hard is it for a human to live a perfect life? Impossible. Okay. Well, see, this is where sometimes my brain explodes, because you know, if Jesus was God, the fact he lived a perfect life, that's no big deal because God's perfect. But now, if he lived it as a human, and he lived a perfect life, now that's amazing. But Jesus was divine, yet he was fully human, and we read in the passage in the New Testament how at the age of 12 he went with his parents to Nazareth. And we see that Jesus, even though he was divine, lived in submission to his parents. He was obedient to them, and he respected generational wisdom. In Luke 2, we read that Jesus went down to Nazareth with his parents and was obedient to them, but his mother treasured all these things in her heart. And Jesus grew in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and men. Jesus, the Son of God, grew in wisdom and in stature. He had to be human. He had to be fully human. Now, the point being is that if the Son of God could grow in stature and in wisdom as a human, can't Jim Oliver? Is it possible that I could, well, I don't know if I can grow more in stature, but, and if my dad's any indication, I probably will shrink a little bit. But if he could grow in wisdom, can't I? Now, how did that occur? Well, we read here, he was what? He was obedient to his parents. His parents taught him. They trained him. Now, that would be an awesome responsibility as a parent, I would think. And it is. But Jesus proposed a radical lifestyle as well for us. We read in John 4, verses 31 and 32. And he was talking with his disciples, and they knew he was hungry because he hadn't eaten. They said, "Rabbi, eat something." But he said to them, "I have food to eat that you know nothing about." How do we find that? How do we find food, the food that Jesus was talking about here, that we know, that humans know nothing about? And later on, and a couple chapters later in John 6, Jesus talks about his own flesh. He says, "But here is the bread that comes down from heaven, which a man may eat and not die. I am the living bread that came down from heaven. If anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever. This bread is my flesh, which I give for the life of the world." And in Luke 14, the high cost of being a disciple, in the same way, any of you who does not give up everything he has cannot be my disciple. These are hard teachings, aren't they? Doesn't this go completely against the grain of what we know? In Matthew 5, he says, "Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled." Do we seek righteousness? Do we hunger for it? Do we look for it each day? Is it hanging on trees all over the place? Is it easy to find? It's in the Word.
You can't stand reading it every minute.
You can't stand reading it what?
You can't stand reading it every minute of the day.
No?
You've got to have it in your mind.
We have to practice, don't we?
When you're out driving that car, you've got to hear it, so it doesn't come, something else doesn't come out here.
We have to practice it. That's exactly right. In Matthew 6, verse 19, it says, "Do not store for yourself treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy, and where thieves break in and steal." So unearthly treasures. In Matthew 5, verse 20, it says, "I tell you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven." In Matthew 5, verse 29, "If your right eye causes you to sin, gouge it out and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for the whole body to be thrown into hell." This is a radical lifestyle that he wants us to live. It's completely different. Now I have a passage on the board here from Proverbs. Proverbs 27, 17. "As iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another." So how do we sharpen iron? How do you sharpen iron? Rub it against iron? How does that apply to us? Now, if I take this and I just kind of bang on it, does that sharpen it? No. So how does that apply to us? You got to rub it correctly? Okay. So what does that imply?
You have to
teach correctly. Okay. Is there anything else?
Rightly dividing the word.
That's true. Anything else? If a good piece of steel, would you ruin it? Would you ruin it on purpose? Would you let a novice go at it? How does we sharpen one another? You know, I just want to give you a couple of my own experiences. Now let us think about how we go about doing this. I think sometimes we don't think of ourselves as iron. I think sometimes we think of ourselves as being really soft. And we don't want to, this is bugging me, so I'm going to take it off. I don't know what it is, but this belongs to Cleo Kellner. But you know, I was told to me, and because I pursued it, I was told that there were some people that didn't want to come to this class, they'd come back whenever I was done teaching. Now, I'm really disappointed in that. Not for them, but for me. Because what can I learn from that person, those people? What could I learn? Could they teach me anything? Not by not being here. Do I teach in error? Do they not like my style?
We have to love the lost, help them, whatever way we can, teach them the truth. But we have to have a love for those that are not doing, following the truth, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That you have to try to encourage them to read and study it and obey it.
Okay. And that's part of the sharpening that comes in with being gentle, being loving, but you still have to pursue it, don't you? I'll give you another one. I have a brother that's been struggling really hard. And in reaching out to help him, guess who gets helped? I get strengthened. I get encouraged. Why? Well, because I struggle with things too. But sometimes as you deal with someone else's struggles, it makes you realize that, hey, what's that?
Life's not that bad.
Why do I give in so easily to the little things that try to knock me down? Someone dealing with some big issues. And here I'm going, that sharpens me. That strengthens me. That encourages me. You know, and as we deal with each other, you know, sometimes we tend to be superficial. And I think that's one of the real blessings with having a small group, small church. Because you get to know one another a little better, you know. And you get involved in each other's lives. And I think that's important. Because how are you going to know if I'm struggling with something unless you know me? I mean, I can stand up here in front and talk big words. Act like I got it all together. But how can you know what I struggle with unless you know me? How can I know what you struggle with unless I know you? And it's important. And I think as groups get bigger, and I'm not trying to advocate that we need to really change the body here. But I think it's important that we look for those that seem to be alone. We look for those that seem to have trouble. And sometimes, you know, I think people are afraid to share because what happens? We blab it all over. And who wants that? I don't want everybody to know what I really struggle with. It's bad enough that my wife has to see it. So how do we sharpen one another? How are we going to encourage one another in our daily walk? How do we go from being an institution to being a living, dynamic organism? If you read about the early church in Acts, it's an active, vibrant group. And church is not a place.
Christ came into the world to seek and to save the lost. But that's what we have to, that's an example for us to follow. To seek the lost and try to teach them, try to get them to read the scripture.
Mm-hmm.
Because they just follow their preachers. What most people do, just follow what their preacher says. They won't read what the Bible, the scriptures, you try to give them,
mm-hmm.
telling them what to do to be saved. They just say, they follow what their preacher says.
Right.
And that's what most of my students do. They don't want to read the scripture. They just want to follow their...
They just want to be told what to do?
Huh?
They just want to be told what to do?
Yeah.
What's that?
To
be just to do what you're told?
Mm-hmm.
Oh man. Wish my kids believe that. Just do as you're told. Okay. But really, you know, I really firmly believe that this life, this radical life that Jesus has us to live, does not just involve us being here today within these walls. I think it has to do with a life-changing deal. And I think if we believe it and we live it, it's going to change everything. It'll change our families. It'll change our society. It'll change our church. It'll change our community. It'll change our lives. Is it easy? No. It's easier to always to listen to someone else and tell us what to do. But what if I don't? But what if, you know, I can't help someone that doesn't want to be helped. But at the same time, how do I help someone that struggles with different things than I do? How do I help someone that's in a different situation than I am? How do I help someone that I have a hard time relating to?
You've got to show love and affection towards someone, even though they're your enemy. They're trying to, you know, condemn you,
mm-hmm.
and trying to stop your work. You've got to show that you do care. You care for people.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to show them the truth in a kind way. We can't in any every time rebuke them and things like that. We've got to be kind in our relationships to those people.
Cool. So we just can't tell them point out the times they do wrong. We can't just run around saying, "Hey, look what you did." I wouldn't want anybody doing that to me. Yes, Danette. And sometimes that's hard to. We have lived in a time, and maybe that's changing some. I don't know, but we have lived in a time when you know, meeting needs, and I use needs. Maybe we confuse wants with needs. We say, well, this is what I want. This is what I want, and so those wants. Wants can be sometimes easy to be filled. At least that's how it's been in the recent past. But needs, what is it that we need? Yes, sir.
I hope this will help. The scripture talks about individual interaction. One man, another man, benefit both. I think where the radicalism of Jesus was this. The Jews of his day had a system. Here's the temple with the sacrifices, these things. And the confidence was in the system. And Jesus said, that's okay, but you need to learn about love, justice, and mercy. And I think we, society, we, Church of Christ, have become more system-oriented than individual-oriented. And I'm going to suggest that do what you're told. This is a strong part of the religious system. Here's the system. It tells you you professionally do this and this, and the confidence in the system. And Jesus, he destroyed this. His prophet is very individual. He called people by name. And in the lives of the converts, it's the individual reaction on each other,
mm-hmm.
not fitting in the system.
Right.
Not filling it, pegging a hole. Mm-hmm. But it is people touched by the gospel of God, redeemed in this grace, interacting in such a way as to make the whole thing better.
Amen.
This is radical, because it's not system theology, but it is a matter of changing people with interactions where we help encourage each other.
Okay, so, I'm sorry.
No, I should stop there.
I think that sometimes we rely too much on the system. And I think, again, it gets back to what Ms. Cummings was saying, that, you know, do as you're told. Okay, well, if you do this, this, and this, then you're okay. You know, and that's exactly what Jesus bucked up against. Because sometimes what we do is the right thing, but is it always the right thing when we're doing it for the wrong reason?
Yep.
But I also think that sometimes we get complacent in our reliance upon the system, or our reliance upon what it is we want. You know, I think that we have several people here today that are either in the military or have been in the military, and you know, sometimes you end up doing things you don't feel comfortable doing, or that you don't want to do. I remember reading about a young man that went to he signed up for Marine First Division. They went to this training where they teach them how to survive in certain circumstances. And they have five categories they use. And so you put down, when you go in there, you put down the five in order how you want to do it. So you put, you know, airborne, you know, jumping out of a plane, water. Anyways, they have five areas. Well, guess what area you get?
The last.
You get the last one. But they don't tell you that when you go in. They think, oh, okay, I'm going to get my first pick maybe, but if I don't get that, I'll get the second pick. But guess what? You always get the last one. Now, why would they do that?
Character.
Yeah, perhaps. But how much do we seek that in our own lives? Do we seek to get outside of our own comfort zone? You know, it's in being involved somewhat with the classes in our church here. And I think Bruce can back me up on this. Guess what is the hardest to find teachers for?
Teenagers.
Yeah, high school. High school, people say, that'd scare me. It's like, come on. Have you been a parent? Have you raised teens? Yeah, well, how can you not know how to deal with a teenager? What's that?
They know it all?
Well, that's partially true. But, you know, it's all I'm trying to say is sometimes, you know, our doing the thing that's radical involves us taking a chance. It involves us stepping out of where we're comfortable, character-wise. And I'm not talking about necessarily teaching teenagers, but I'm talking about, you know, going to somebody that's struggling. I mean, how hard is it to approach somebody that you know is struggling with something? It's not easy, because you go, well, how do I say this? How do I start it? You know, and I think that's one of the big things about that's happened in the church. You know, we don't want to confront sin. We don't want to confront troubles where people are struggling. Because first of all, how do we do that? How do I do that without somebody going, well, you know what, I've seen you. Well.
You know, sometimes, Jim, the one thing a person needs struggling is somebody there to show them that they care. The most important thing right there. Not that you're going to fix everything right there, but they need to show them you care and you'll be there for them. That's so big.
But that involves not a one-time thing, though, does it? And that's not, you know, we live busy lives. You know, that's something we always struggle with. You know, we have busy lives. What is most important?
But if you really care, you'll find time.
Well, that's real easy to say. And I don't mean to push back too hard, but I think, you know, it's not always easy, because sometimes there are lots of demands that are placed upon you. And you are right, we would make time. We should make time. You know, as we read about Jesus in the Gospels, there were many times when just like the passage I read earlier from John. I mean, why would the apostles talk to him about getting something to eat if they weren't hungry? We know that when he went to Samaria and talked to the woman at the well, he had sent the apostles to go get some food because they were hungry. They'd been traveling. They were hungry. Hunger's, you know, something that's, you know, when we get hungry, we want to fill it. But Jesus wasn't concerned about eating a lot of times. He was more concerned about feeding those that needed spiritual feeding. And I fear, really, in our own lives, sometimes we spend too much time trying to feed our hungers, our own hungers, whatever they might be. You know, and I think that sometimes as older people, we've given a really poor example to our kids, our young adult kids, you know, as to what is it that is important in our lives. Is it taking care of myself? Is it, what's that?
Things.
Okay, it could be things. Doing what I want to do. You know, what is one of the things we mock men about? Well, got to control the clicker. Clicker control.
We need to put the Lord first in anything we do. Put him first, and then go on and do the best you can with your work and with your play or whatever you're doing. But we need to put the Lord first.
Okay.
In our lives.
So not put ourselves out as the most important, but to put things that the Lord would have us do first. Now that's kind of a hard thing to do. But you know, I have other responsibilities in my life, though. I have people that are dependent upon me.
And they did the most wonderful thing to help me with the garage sale, to help my sister. They didn't even know her. They don't even go to she doesn't even go to this church. And she will not go to this church. She goes to the Greek church, which is fine. But they did wonderful caring thing, and they were there for hours every day.
Okay.
That is love. And that's care.
That's great. And that's great. And that's what we should aspire to do. I mean, we all have things in our lives that kind of pull us apart, and I think Satan uses that every day to try to get us to question what it is we're doing. Yes, ma'am. Right.
And they went to sleep. And maybe we really, deep down, don't understand the importance of what we're doing here and what it's going to mean when it comes time for God to judge us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was just another evening.
Where the apostles sleeping.
Yeah. Does this guy ever rest? Doesn't he ever let up? You know, you know, and that's a good point too, because you know Jesus in his own life knew that his time was limited. He knew that that something, you know, what he was headed for. I mean, he knew it. I know. But, you know, do we take that seriously?
No, we should.
Do we take it seriously that you know, tomorrow it all might be gone? And I think also, too, though, we miss out on a lot of joy, a lot of happiness. I would be willing to bet, Nikki, that all those people that helped you, even if they were tired and just ready to put their feet up, I bet they all had a great experience. I think they probably...
Yeah,
you what?
We had fun.
They had fun?
And lunch.
And lunch.
Mm-hmm. Like Bob, your dad said, he interacted with people. And when he was to have gone to the end of his day, when he was so tired, he was going to rest, and here are all these people mm-hmm. waiting to see him. He didn't just put out his hands and say, be healed. He went and touched each one of them.
Yeah.
He used his energy beyond what he had thought he had. Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, you had to add on that little part that, of course, he was divine. But see, I know. But you know what? The only thing I think of that as I read the Gospels, and I could be wrong. This is my own thinking, though. The only way the divine part played in was he could see into people's hearts. I don't have that ability. I don't know if someone's always being. Right off the bat, if they're being truthful or honest or
really
yeah, where Jesus knew, Jesus could see right into their hearts, but I think that you know, sometimes we pursue so hard where we think there's going to be some kind of good and joy that we lose out on those moments when we've done something.
There is good joy in the Word of God. You have a counselor for all.
No, you're right. You're right. But we don't see that sometimes because there's so much hard work. We see maybe there's so much hard work in getting there. Yes, ma'am.
I need the Lord's help. And I always pray for the Lord to help me. Because there's so many things I'm getting where I can't do.
No way.
And I pray for the Lord's help. And,
mm-hmm.
and I can finally get it done, you know, whenever I get his help.
Mm-hmm.
I'm getting where I can't button buttons like my husband got to where he couldn't button his buttons. I'm getting where I can't button my buttons like that. And he wouldn't blame his fingers on it, you know. He always said they don't make buttonholes like that.
That's right. And I think that's true. And thank God for zippers, or T-shirts. No, you're right. You know, it's it kind of brings to mind the. I don't know if any of you guys read James Michener. There was I think the name of the book was called Poland. Was there one called Poland? Anyways, it had to do with it was set in the Second World War in in Auschwitz, and there was a rabbi that, anyways, the Germans, I guess, in the story, I don't know if it's real or not, but in the Germans would herd into the small room. There was a small room, and there was like one little window, and they would herd 60 Jews into this small room. And what they would do, what the reason for it was, the window was so small, there were so many people in there, that there was it would be lack of oxygen. There'd be just a certain amount of oxygen. Anyways, this one Jewish man was befriended by this rabbi. And the rabbi had told him, he goes, if you ever get in that room, he says, stay away from the window. Don't go near the window. And the guy thought, well, that's kind of weird because that's where the air's coming in. So, but anyways, when one day they got herded up, a bunch of them, and he got herded up in this group, and they put him in the this room, and he fought real hard to get away from the window. And the next day, the next morning, out of the 60 that went in there, approximately 60 went in there, there were only 14 of them alive. Because as they herd them in there, they went over to the, they tried to crowd to the windows so they could get to the air. And the big ones, you know, would push the little ones out of the way. And some of them got stomped and beat up so that, you know, they could get over there. And some just died from lack of oxygen. So anyways, they let him out, and he tried to find to see if the rabbi was in there, but the rabbi wasn't in there. And so as he went out to the field, they made him go out and work, and there he saw the rabbi. And the rabbi wanted to come over and talk to him. His eyes lit up when he saw that he was still alive. But when he went to go talk to him, the Germans struck him down. They ended up beating the rabbi to death. But the point of the story is the rabbi had given this man some advice, and he followed it, and he was happy to see him alive. He was happy to the point he got the joy from even something that we would look upon as being totally miserable and just a waste of human life. But in that brief moment, the smile that the guy saw on the rabbi's face just made him realize that this man cared about him and was willing to even die for it. And as we look at I know Ms. Cummings said she talked about praying for the strength to do things that she thinks she can't do anymore physically. And as we live our lives, do we seek Jesus in it? Do we realize that He gave everything for me? And do we seek Him in our lives each day? You know, so many times we have it so easy. I don't feel like we struggle. We don't appreciate the things that are going on. And there are people, even amongst the 200 or so that meet here, there are people that are struggling. There's things in their lives. Some they can control, some they can't. And do we know that? Now, sometimes it's hard because people don't always want to share. But we can reach out and show them the love that God has shown us. But we can't appreciate it unless we work at it. I have to work at it every day. And if I don't, I'm going to get lazy. And when I get lazy, And we don't look for opportunities to go out and do something good for somebody else, somebody that needs it. And I think that, you know, as I think it's true of all of our lives, but I want to speak to you 20-somethings there in the back for just a minute. Because, you know, I see it in my own two oldest kids' lives. You know, sometimes we're not challenged. We don't see that there's a challenge in things. You know, we kind of live our own lives. And I remember being your age, believe it or not. But I do remember being in my early 20s. You know, and life is there for your picking. It's there. You know, and there's things you can do. You can do whatever you want. You haven't got yourself tied down, you're old enough that you don't have to answer to your parents anymore. Although sometimes we don't feel that way. But it's, you know, we don't see the challenge that comes, that's there for us. And so we just kind of drift along. And we kind of take what comes. And I think Satan does that to us sometimes. Because he'll put plums out there in front of us and we say, well, it's easy. It's easy pickings, but we don't see the path that he's taken us down, or the path that we're going down, and the trouble that we're causing, not only amongst our own lives, but amongst those that we come in contact with. And I think part of it too is the fact that the society we've we live in has made it so easy. Now, you may not think it's easy. Do y'all think it's easy? Not sure, huh? Well, I think sometimes, you know, I know my own kids are reluctant to say things sometimes, because they, at least in my presence, because I might try to sharpen them a little bit. But you know, there's so much out there that sometimes it's hard to know where to go, what to do, what direction to take. And I think that if we concentrate on living our lives the way Jesus, things happen. Things are there for us to respond to. And I know that each of us need encouragement. Each of us need prodding. Each of us need to be pushed a little bit. You know, I think that how many of us don't respond a little bit to discomfort? Is there nobody that responds to discomfort? You don't respond to discomfort? Oh, you do. I must have said a double negative. A double negative? None of us like to be uncomfortable, do we? And so we try to go in a direction that just is easy for us. But what do the scriptures say about the easy path? What's that?
It's not where you
want to go. What'd you say?
It's broad.
It's broad. And where does it lead to? Leads to destruction. Now, how many of us want to take that path?
We wouldn't deliberately take it, but we would lazily take it.
Mm-hmm. I was reading about somebody. Oh, I think it was Keith. In the bulletin article about the coworker, or was it a coworker that left work and got in the accident?
Yeah.
Yeah. He had no idea. You know, and sometimes we think that we know how things are going to turn out. And that guy didn't. I've had, in this last month, I've had 5 clients that have passed away. Some old, some young. They didn't know. Didn't it?
Ezekiel was sent out to preach. He was sent to preach with knowing that he would fail. He was sent to preach to people who were shutting their ears.
Mm-hmm. And that says a lot to me, doesn't it? Because, I mean, if you know what is right, if you know what is the direction to go, how can you keep silent about it? You know, and we read many times through the Bible. I mean, there were several Old Testament prophets that had the same problem. You know, they knew that the people weren't going to listen. We know that my dad's probably going to correct me on this, but I think it was Peter and... Was it Peter and who was in prison? And they were told that they were released, but said that they just weren't supposed to preach the gospel anymore.
Peter.
It was Peter? Was it just Peter? And what did he say? Sorry, I can't. I can't not speak it.
Ask the Lord's help.
Okay. Well, I would like to encourage each one of us to seek God's guidance. I would encourage each one of us to try to find a brother or find a sister that you can sharpen each other. Encourage each other as to how to live your life, a life that is seeking righteousness, a life that cuts against the grain of what society tells us we should do, or what we even feel comfortable doing. I want to challenge each of us to each day to try to find out what God has in store for us, to look for opportunities to help those that need help, regardless of what society tells us is the right thing to do, or is the proper thing to do, or any other thing that goes against the grain of what God teaches us. Because it is a life commitment. And if we live like no one else, later on we can live like no one else. Because it is a choice that we get to make. And part of that choice involves working. It involves, as Jesus showed us with his own life, each day seeking opportunities to help others, seeking opportunities to show the world the difference between living for oneself and living for Christ. Because it is a difference. And as Nikki pointed out, when you see it, you notice it. And maybe we think it's not going to make any difference, but how can we know? Because the Bible doesn't put the responsibility on us. It only puts the responsibility on us to plant the seed, to give the opportunity for someone to hear. Because part of the Great Commission is to spread the gospel, to teach, to live a life that Christ would have us to live. But it takes effort, folks. It doesn't come naturally. Some of us were trained that way, some of us weren't. For some, it's harder. For some, they need more encouragement. Sometimes we are the ones that are supposed to be the encourager. Sometimes we're the one that's supposed to spur them on to live the life that they should live. Anyway, anybody have any comments? Anything to add, subtract? Uh-oh. Yes, sir.
This is a series of choices that's not only foisted on Christians. I wonder who that first guy was who bought a pair of pants that were 6 inches too long and decided to wear below his navel. He's had tremendous influence. There are millions of people who are dressed this way. And there's a Verizon commercial with a young girl going down the escalator in the department store to buy her first clothes. And she has this picture. She's going to dress like somebody. And one of the blessings of being, and this sounds terribly egotistical, but it's what God has done for us. Ephesians 1 talks about prayer that the eyes of your heart being enlightened in order to know the hope to which you've called. Christians have a different basis of choice because God has touched our hearts and enlightened us. But we make a choice. What kind of clothes we're going to wear? And our choices are different, not because we're better or smarter, but because God has had an impact on our life. And we illustrate that impact in life by conversation, by clothes we wear, place we go. And so we're different. Thanks be to God, because he's visited our lives. And this is a radical thing, and able to follow the leading of the Lord, revealed in Jesus, revealed in the Word, rather than the first guy who decided it was nice to show his rear cleavage and walk down the street. They're about lifestyles. Make good choices.
That's true.
But we've been enlightened and should be able to make it better.
Yeah.
So then back to where you are. We live like this. Iron sharpening each other.
Yeah. I'm not sure that we all needed the visual picture, though, that you just presented us throughout the rest of the day.
But everybody got
I know. Just It just used to be, it used to just be the realm of Joe the plumber, but now it's, I know. Well, I don't know. I don't know if I can add to that. Anyway, in closing, I do want to encourage you sincerely to, and some of you have, and I really appreciate it, but to challenge me. Yes, ma'am. Okay.
I want you to know that I think that's my very favorite group, because they're very perceptive and they see right through the very core, and they know if you're true and genuine and if you're not. And if you're true and genuine with those teenagers, they'll prove you 100% every single time. I think they're one of the best groups out there, just because they have so much fun and it's one of the truth.
Well, that's true. That's you're exactly right, but they do so many dumb things. No, I know. I just. Yeah. Well. That's I don't know why they scare so many people. I think it's and maybe it's just because of all the things you pointed out that they are and. I think that, you know, really, at that age, they want to know, you know, and they want someone to push them and to guide them and to give them answers. And I think that's where we fall short so many times is we don't give them answers.
They just want you to listen.
They what?
A lot of times they don't want you to tell them what to do. They
A little slap, is that what you said?
S-L-I-C-K.
Oh, slack. All right, well, thank you.